result, we realise that they didn't want to make a deal. For their part, the major Hollywood studios have said their goal is to reach a fair deal. They've cited their own set of challenges, including pressure from investors to cut costs and build profitable streaming businesses, a slowing national economy, and long-term declines in box office revenues. Amid the upheaval, companies such as Netflix, Warner Brothers, Discovery, and Disney have laid off thousands of employees. Sky News has also covered this story and tells us more. The Writers Guild of America has voted to strike after talks with Hollywood studios failed. The last Writers Guild of America strike in 2007 and 2008 lasted 100 days. The action could cost the economy of California an estimated $2.1 billion. Television and movie writers are going on strike for the first time in 15 years in a dispute over fair pay in the streaming era. The Writers Guild of America said its 11,500 unionized screenwriters will head to the picket lines on Tuesday. Negotiations between studios and the writers, which began in March, failed to reach a new contract before the writers' current deal expired on Monday, 1st of May. All script writing is to immediately cease, the guild informed its members. The dispute could hit television and film productions depending on how long the strike lasts. Late night US talk shows such as Jimmy Kimmel Live and The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon are expected to go dark immediately and air reruns. Next to be disrupted could be daytime soap operas, since they're traditionally written not long before they're filmed. Primetime comedies and dramas currently on air should be able to wrap up seasons uninterrupted. Their episodes for the coming weeks will have already been written and filmed. Netflix, which makes shows around the world, has said it can feed its service with shows produced outside of the United States, but its US-based series will be affected if a strike drags on. The board of directors for the Writers Guild of America, which includes both a West and an East branch, voted unanimously to call for a strike. The company's behavior has created a gig economy inside the union workforce, and their immovable stance in this negotiation has betrayed a commitment to further devalue the profession of writing, the Writers Guild of America said in a statement. The statement added, from their refusal to guarantee any level of weekly employment in episodic television, to the creation of a day rate in comedy variety, to their stonewalling on free work for screenwriters and on artificial intelligence for all writers, they have closed the door on their labor force and opened the door to writing as an entirely freelance profession. No such deal could ever be contemplated by the membership of the Writers Guild of America.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakah.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, and he was the 9th divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was brought up in the house of Nubuwa, Prophethood, and Imamat, a house by which Allah had honored the Muslims all across the world. And so Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam grew up in the shade of that honored and noble house, while he received high ideals, morals, values, knowledge, and wisdom from his father, the 8th divinely appointed Imam, who shed rays of light from his great soul unto Imam al-Jawad. Imam al-Jawad's father, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, himself had undertaken the upbringing, the nurturing, the education of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. And so we find that Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam took Imam al-Jawad with him wherever he went and fed him with his own hands. A divinely appointed Imam, nurtured and educated by a divinely appointed Imam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your listeners. It's great to have you with us. You are listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. We have heard the various descriptions of the Almighty Allah. Of course, when we say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, we are saying in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful, the one who is merciful to both his creatures in this world and the next. And of course, he is the all-merciful and all-encompassing mercy. The Almighty Allah is the most compassionate, the most kind, the most merciful, and of course, the most quick to forgive. These beautiful attributes of the Almighty Allah, which truly make his servants and his creatures in awe of the majesty of the Almighty Allah. We find in a conversation with Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, who was speaking with his companions about certain descriptions of the Almighty Allah, that His Eminence, the 9th divinely appointed Imam, said, "When someone commits a sin and they know that Allah sees them, and that Allah may punish them if Allah likes, or if Allah wishes, He will forgive them. Allah will forgive that individual even before they ask Allah for forgiveness." What a beautiful description of the Almighty Allah, His mercy, His most quick to forgive. But of course, here there are certain things that we must on our behalf do. One is, of course, that if, God forbid, we commit a sin, then we should know that the Almighty Allah has seen us. The Almighty Allah has witnessed this committing of sin and this committing of disobedience by us. And, of course, after realizing that the Almighty Allah has seen us and has witnessed us committing a certain sin, then we must realize that we are at the mercy of the Almighty Allah as to whether He will forgive us or He will punish us for committing that sin. Once we realize these things, the natural result is that we will hasten towards asking for forgiveness from the Almighty Allah. And it is this point that before we even ask for forgiveness from the Almighty Allah, that He forgives us that sin that we committed. A beautiful description that has been given to us about the mercy and the compassion and the kindness of the Almighty Allah. If we do commit a mistake, we must realize that we have been watched and it has been witnessed by the Almighty Allah, and that we are truly at His mercy, whether He wants to forgive us or punish us. And if we are to do this, the Almighty Allah will forgive us even before us asking for forgiveness. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Imam Al-Jawad salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi is an interesting case study for many, many different subjects. In the case of the ninth imam, there was a lot of controversy surrounding his imamate. And as we know, in many occasions, the imamate is not a matter of public opinion or public choice. In fact, Imam Rida, in a very beautiful hadith in Ma'ani al-Akhbar and al-Kafi, it is narrated in a very long hadith where Imam Rida gives the attributes of the imams based on the Quran and so on and so forth. It's a very, very beautiful hadith where he continues to mention again and again and again that the qadr of the imama, the sha'n of the imama, the weight of the imama is such that it cannot be left to public opinion. It is not a democratic vote among the Hashemites who get together and decide who they think is the best candidate to succeed, or the Quraysh, or or this tribe or that tribe. There is no such thing as this. The imam is designated by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, period. There is no such thing as ikhtiyar. In fact, Imam Rida goes on to call the people who think that this is a matter of public choice and preference are fools, and not only fools, they are ignorant fools, he uses the word. Juhal, he says. Again and again and again. Anyone who thinks the imamate is a matter of public preference might as well apply the same rules to the religion itself. Because if the perfection of religion lies in wilaya, then the religion might as well be up to the preferences of the people. So thus the imamate cannot be left to the preferences of the people.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales.
Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In 2001, the gross U.S. government debt reached $5.8 trillion, which was about 55% of America's gross domestic product, or GDP. But this debt in 2023, this year, has reached $31.4 trillion, which is nearly 125% of America's gross domestic product, or GDP. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Wall Street Journal has covered this story and tells us more. The United States Treasury has warned that the U.S. government will be unlikely to meet payment obligations by early June if the debt ceiling is not raised. The date is earlier than the Treasury estimated in January, indicating that the United States' financial situation is more precarious than previously thought. In a letter to Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy, published on Monday, 1st of May, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen asked Congress to increase the government's debt ceiling before this date or to suspend its implementation in order to prevent economic turmoil. After reaching the borrowing cap of $31.4 trillion on 19th of January, Janet Yellen informed Congress that the Treasury would use cash receipts and extraordinary cash management measures to continue making payments on debt, federal benefits and other expenditures, at least through to 5th of June. Previously, economists had predicted Washington's debt would increase to the set limit by the end of early August, and the collection of less-than-expected tax revenues will speed the process. Experts believe the United States could default on its debt obligations if the debt ceiling is not raised by the summer, triggering an economic downturn that could result in a recession, create an unemployment crisis, and damage the country's reputation as a safe haven for investors. The economic outlook in the United States is clouded by a deepening rivalry between the Biden administration and Republican lawmakers, who are demanding drastic spending cuts in exchange for more government borrowing power. For the past 2 months, the White House has refused to talk to Kevin McCarthy and has demanded that the Republican-controlled Congress unconditionally approve the increase in the debt ceiling. President Joe Biden accused Republicans of holding the economy hostage to politically motivated demands and said he would discuss spending issues only in the context of the budget, not in relation to the debt ceiling. In the coming days, the Republican plan to increase the federal government's debt ceiling and reduce government spending will go to Congress. In 2011, a similar struggle over the debt ceiling brought the country to the brink of default, resulting in a downgrade of the United States' main credit rating. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered this story. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has sounded the alarm that a failure by Congress to raise the government's debt ceiling would eventually trigger an economic catastrophe. Janet Yellen said on Tuesday, 25th of April, at the Sacramento Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce Members Summit in Washington, she said, "A default on our debt would produce an economic and financial catastrophe." She added, "A default would raise the cost of borrowing into perpetuity. Future investments would become substantially more costly." Janet Yellen warned that failure by Congress to raise the government's debt ceiling and the resulting default on U.S. debt would result in job losses and higher interest rates for years to come. She also warned if Congress fails to do so, the government will likely run out of money to pay its bills. It will most likely be unable to issue payments to military families and to seniors who rely on Social Security, and U.S. businesses will face deteriorating credit markets, further adding that household payments on mortgages, auto loans and credit cards would all go up as well. Janet Yellen insisted that it was the basic responsibility of Congress to increase or suspend the $31.4 trillion borrowing cap set for the government without delay. She said, "Congress must vote to raise or to suspend the debt limit. It should do so without conditions, and it should not wait until last minute." After the January due date had expired, the U.S. Treasury Secretary told lawmakers in February that the government will likely run out of money by early June. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives is scheduled to vote in the coming days on raising the U.S. government's debt ceiling by $1.5 trillion. However, Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, suggested recently that the Republican plan would be to link their approval of an increase of $1.5 trillion to the debt ceiling to a decrease of $4.5 trillion in public spending. Treasury says the two issues should not be linked, and the Democratic-controlled Senate is likely to reject the GOP plan amid a standoff between Democrats and Republicans, who have refused to support raising or suspending the debt ceiling. Meanwhile, the deadlock in negotiations has made movers and shakers in financial markets increasingly jittery, sending the cost of insuring exposure to U.S. debt soaring to its highest level in a decade, with financial analysts warning about the growing risk of a default on U.S. debt. Agence France-Presse news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. According to recent Congressional Budget Office estimates, the United States risks defaulting on payment obligations as soon as July if lawmakers fail to resolve a gridlock and raise the federal borrowing limit. The forecast by the nonpartisan office serving Congress comes as Republicans threaten to block the usually rubber-stamp approval for raising the nation's credit limit if Democrats do not first agree to steep future budget cuts. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, said if the debt limit remains unchanged, the government's ability to borrow using extraordinary measures will be exhausted between July and September of 2023. The latest estimate provides another benchmark on top of the Treasury Department's expectations. In January, the U.S. hit its $31.4 trillion borrowing cap, prompting the Treasury to start measures that allow it to continue financing the government's activities. The Treasury earlier said its cash and extraordinary measures would likely last until early June. The Congressional Budget Office warned recently if the debt limit is not raised or suspended before the extraordinary measures are exhausted, the government would be unable to pay its obligations fully. As a result, the government would have to delay making payments for some activities, default on its debt obligations, or even both. The Congressional Budget Office said, but the date when measures are exhausted remains uncertain, as the timing and amount of revenue collections and spending could differ from projections. The statement added, in particular, if collections fall short, the Treasury could run out of funds before July. The White House accuses Republicans of taking the U.S. economy hostage in order to posture as fiscally responsible. Recently, Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer told reporters, "We're continuing to speak to how bad it would be to allow the nation to default. It's going to affect every American family badly." In a separate report released recently, the Congressional Budget Office said it projects a federal budget deficit of $1.4 trillion for 2023. This amounts to 5.3% of gross domestic product, or GDP, and is set to reach 6.9% of gross domestic product, GDP, in 2033, a level exceeded only five times since 1946, and a shortfall is set to hit $2.7 trillion in 2033. Meanwhile, the Congressional Budget Office said that the debt to gross domestic product ratio is expected to rise each year, hitting a record high of 118% by 2033. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, added, debt would continue to grow beyond 2033 if current laws generally remained unchanged.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to manage our friendship. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salaamu Alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this session, we are going to start our discussion with a very wise question. Someone has asked that, I am a teenager from a religious family. I have a friend who is corrupt, but I'm very fond of him, but I don't know what to do. It's a very wise question, and it's very common for everyone to have such friend, and perhaps most of us have experienced this situation. So it's very important to understand how to manage these kind of friendships. Okay, so in answer, we should know that use our love and kindliness towards our friend as a means of advising him and saving him by taking him towards guidance. It has been narrated from Prophet ﷺ that guiding one person is better than worldly life and all it contains. So our first step and our first main and purpose of this kind of friendships is to help our friend and take him towards guidance and advise him using our loves and our kindliness. And in many cases, by treating our friends in this way, we can easily help them and we can make many big changes in their lives as well. So the first duty that we have towards our friends is to help them. So if we see we can help them, we can study the religious books and the books containing the issues of this topic to understand the ways of helping our friends in our social connection. But there is a point I am going to mention in the second part. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z on IRIB English Radio. In the previous part, we talked about the if you have a friend who is corrupt, how to behave with this kind of friends. Okay, and the first step and the first aim of making this kind of friendships is to help our friends by taking them towards guidance, by using our life and kindness. But there is a very important point that we should not forget, that love is good when it reaps goodness. And it is a means of deviation when it transfers bad morals from your friend to you. So we have to be aware of this aspect of friendship as well. A rational person is one who thinks of the outcome of things and then considers the actual situation. I mean, he considers what is important and what is more important. So in this case, friendship can be important, but what is more important? This is that we have to be sure that the bad morals from our friend doesn't transfer to us and becomes our personality. So, in this case, we need to try to be more reasonable than sentimental. Because if emotion overpowers us in the important situations, it will destroy us and then convey us to hell, definitely, and feeling regret entirely. Of course, this is not what we want, nor can be. And of course, this is not what we want. And we cannot tolerate such a situation.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
According to World Trade Organization, global food prices are likely to soar higher in 2023. According to the organization, costs shot up by nearly 20% last year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT reported food prices surged 18% globally last year, including a 21% rise in the cost of grain. The World Trade Organization, WTO, estimated in its global trade outlook published recently. According to the organization, fertilizer prices saw an even larger increase of 63% year-on-year. The WTO noted that, in theory, higher food costs should encourage more agricultural production, resulting in greater availability and lower prices for food in the future, but warned that move expensive fertilizers could lead to reduced crop yields and ultimately new price spikes. The organization also noted that food prices fluctuated strongly in 2022, first jumping 19% between January and May, following the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine, and then dropping 15% between May and December. Overall, while global food supplies are less precarious than many had feared in connection with the Russia-Ukraine crisis, they remain a cause for concern, WTO warned. According to its calculations, the volume of world wheat trade, for instance, fell roughly 7.5% since 2021, which leaves little margin for error if a major producer suffers a crop failure or climate-related natural disaster. WTO Director General Negotsi Okonjo-Iweala recently called on developed economies to be vigilant to sign of the food crisis triggering hunger in poorer nations. She reiterated her earlier calls for lifting export restrictions on food and fertilizers, noting that as of April 2023, some 67 countries have such curbs. She also warned that global trade is likely to remain under pressure from external factors in 2023. According to her, these include the crisis in Ukraine and other geopolitical tensions, inflation, and the impact of tightening monetary policy. She concluded, this makes it even more important for governments to avoid trade fragmentation and refrain from introducing obstacles to trade. Investing in multilateral cooperation on trade would bolster economic growth and people's living standards over the long term. According to Reuters, shoppers around the world will have to pay even more for groceries this year than they did in 2022. Reuters reported recently, citing retailers, consumer goods firms, and investors. The report indicated that tough price negotiations have been unfolding between retailers and consumer goods producers for more than a year now, with friction beginning in 2021 over COVID-related supply chain logjams. The situation worsened in 2022 as the skyrocketing prices of basic foodstuffs have exacerbated a cost of living crisis in the EU and the UK. Data by research firm Kantar shows that Britons paid a record 16.7% more for food in the 4 weeks up to January 22 this year, compared to the same period last year. Meanwhile, the U.S. Food Index, which includes meals eaten at home and in cafes and restaurants, jumped 10.4% for the year ending in December. Food giant Nestlé's CEO Mark Schindler told media outlets last week that the company would have to hike the prices of its food products further this year in 2023 to offset higher production costs that it has yet to fully pass on to consumers. Another leading manufacturer of consumer goods, Unilever, is also expected to increase prices for some products in 2023. Portfolio manager of Waverton Investment Management, Tinke Frike, said the last time we heard from Unilever, it was made clear that they prefer to sell fewer products at higher prices to keep prices below peers and gain market share. The world's biggest retailer, Walmart, warned in December that some packaged goods suppliers are still pointing us towards more inflation next year, on top of the mid-double digits this year. According to Bernstein analyst Bruno Montien, consumer goods manufacturers will continue to raise prices until they recover their profitability. He explained to Reuters, the only thing that can stop this is consumers starting to trade down to private label products at a more rapid pace. And if commodities keep declining, then there may be no need for more price increases.
IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei in a meeting with Iranian officials and the ambassadors of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr on April 22, 2023. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. All praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds. And peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I would like to congratulate all the respected people here in this meeting, including the heads of Iran's executive branches, our officials, and the ambassadors and representatives of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr. I would also like to congratulate the entire Iranian nation, who are truly deserving of congratulations because of their behaviour and their meritorious deeds during the month of Ramadan. I would also like to extend my congratulations to all of the Muslims in the world and the entire Islamic nation. I hope that the Almighty God will bless everyone during this Eid. The month of Ramadan provides the environment for hearts to become closer to each other.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
All of the various dimensions of the month of Ramadan help to bring the hearts of people closer to each other, both within the country and within the entire Islamic Ummah. First of all, the tenderness that is created in people by their fasting, prayers, supplications, and recitation of the Quran is itself a source for bringing the hearts closer together. And piety brings hearts together just as the President pointed out in his statements. He stated this very well when he said that the secret to fasting is piety. In my opinion, the officials of Islamic countries should use this opportunity to increase unity and closeness among the members of the Islamic nation. Our problem today is division. Even though the Quran prohibits division, do not be like those who became divided into sects and differed. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 105. And it commands us to be united. وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا Hold fast altogether to Allah's rope and do not be divided. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 103. The members of the Islamic nation, the Islamic Ummah, are divided. Yes, there are different opinions, there are different sects, and there are different tastes. That's fine. But these different tastes do not mean that we should be deprived of the great blessings of the Islamic nation being united.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi arrived in Damascus on Wednesday leading a high-ranking delegation. The president then headed to the presidential palace where he was received by his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad with an official welcoming ceremony. The two officials held talks in which Assad underlined the importance and depth of relations with the Islamic Republic. He noted that both countries share visions based on respecting mutual interests and the two countries' sovereignty. Assad thanked Iran for its mediation efforts in Syria-Turkey peace talks and expressed support for Iran's right to peaceful nuclear energy. Raisi, for his part, congratulated Assad on Syria's victory in the war on his country, hailing resistance as an effective tool for free people of the world. He stressed relations between Syria and Iran were never affected by regional or international developments, reiterating his country's support for the people and government of Syria.
We discussed different topics as well as means of boosting our bilateral relations. We are determined to develop and expand our ties with regional states without a presence of foreigners, as they only cause instability. We should get rid of U.S. forces in our region. Securing Syria's sovereignty necessitates the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
The two presidents signed a long-term strategic comprehensive cooperation agreement. Ministers of both countries also signed a number of memorandums of understanding in the fields of oil, agriculture, rail and aerial transportation, free trade zones, earthquake reliefs, communications and information technologies.
Agreements today, as well as projects discussed, will push forward our relations through mechanisms that will increase the bulk of trade exchange and investments. This would reduce the impact of economic sanctions, especially at a time when world economic balance is shifting eastwards, and this would liberate world economies from Western hegemonies.
Assad also welcomed the restoration of diplomatic ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Officials are also set to discuss the establishment of a joint bank and insurance entity that would facilitate trade. The visit further consolidates the already historic and strong ties between Iran and Syria. It clearly launches a new phase of economic partnership following a successful military and political collaboration that set an example in the region in fighting terror and foiling U.S. and Western plots. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
It was his sixth hunger strike and the longest, which lasted for 87 consecutive days. Palestinian prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan stubbornly resisted until his last breath, asking for his release he always obtained after every hunger strike against his illegal administrative detention by the Israeli authorities. This time, however, his hunger strike ended with his martyrdom in a cold cell in the Israeli prison of Ramli at dawn on Tuesday. Here in his hometown, Arabi, near the occupied Jenin, his wife spoke to the crowd who gathered outside their home to consolidate the family and his nine children. They called for his revenge and also for all Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails.
I congratulate myself and my children for the martyrdom of Sheikh Khadr. Now, after his death and all the sacrifices he made, we do not want a drop of his blood to be spilled. We will not wait for anyone to avenge my husband. His nine children will keep his cause alive. And to the Israeli occupation, I say, remember the faces of my children well. By God, we have raised them with pride and dignity.
A general strike has been announced across the occupied West Bank in mourning for Sheikh Khadr Adnan. Protests have been held in several areas, including Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups have mourned what they described as the execution of the senior leader of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, Khadr Adnan. They say they hold the Israeli occupying regime fully responsible for Adnan's murder. Since 2004, Adnan had gone on six hunger strikes, drawing local and international attention. Not only did he become a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, but also a symbol for the cause of Palestinian prisoners.
The Israeli regime has sent a clear message to the whole world that we will continue killing Palestinians even after their imprisonment. Today, Sheikh Khadr Adnan has set a new level full of pride in the history of Palestinian prisoner movement. After his assassination, the Palestinian people are facing a new stage of struggle. Today, we all must unite and stand against the practices of the Israeli regime for the sake of our prisoners.
All Palestine is sad for the martyrdom of the hero prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan. It was not his first hunger strike. Every time he was courageously declaring a hunger strike to reject the illegal administrative detention that the occupation's regime uses to keep thousands of our people behind bars. Unfortunately, this time his strike came to an end with his martyrdom.
Meanwhile, several protests have been held in the occupied Ramallah in response to the Israeli murder of Sheikh Khadr Adnan. The demonstrations turned violent in a number of areas, namely the cities of Ar-Ram, Al-Khalil, and Ramallah, with clashes erupting between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian protesters. Israeli forces fired at the crowds, and a number of Palestinians were wounded. The Day of Rage will always be remembered as a day of honor and loyalty to Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who is considered by many here as a national hero.
Every time Sheikh Khadr Adnan engaged in a hunger strike, he insisted that he will not end his action without achieving victory. His definition of victory was either getting released or being martyred. This time, he achieved victory by martyrdom. Palestinians also believe he was an iconic figure who succeeded in bringing another defeat to the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Against the backdrop of that all-familiar soundtrack and amid heavy police presence, pro-Palestinian protesters outside the Leicester branch of the notorious Israeli arms maker Elbit Systems. A short walk into the woods from the demo, members of the Palestine Action Group, donning the iconic Palestinian keffiyeh with one purpose in mind.
I'd like to see Elbit out of the UK. I'd like to see Elbit shut down once and for all in the whole world. But obviously, you know, where we are and what we can do is get Elbit out of the UK. And ultimately, that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see Elbit Systems completely gone from UK soil.
Beyond the steel fence and barbed wire, Elbit's UAV tactical systems manufactures drones on UK soil. Drones allegedly tested on the captive population of Gaza.
When I was there in Gaza for 2 years, I saw what those weapons do, and they are knowingly making them, selling them. In fact, they are even marketing them based on how much horror they have committed across Palestine and still ongoing.
Members of Palestine Action and other Palestinian supporters have come here today saying they're having to take direct action against Elbit Systems because lobbying the British government through normal channels is futile. And they're calling on people around the world to join their campaign to put an end to Israel's international arms trade.
Elbit, Israel's largest weapons maker, used to host 10 sites across Britain. 18 months of protests and blockades by Palestine Action forced its site in Oldham, Greater Manchester, shut last year.
And it's time that Israel finally got brought to justice. We've seen enough horror, murder, oppression, occupation, ethnic cleansing. Enough! We've had enough!
The last time Palestine Action tried to close Elbit's Leicester site was 2 years ago. This time, they say, they won't leave until they have finished the job. Saeed Pariza, London.
It has become a well-trodden political path. Press TV being attacked in the British Parliament. This time the mouthpiece was the vice chair of the Conservatives' Friends of Israel.
A shocking report into the online activities of Press TV, particularly their use of a video series called Palestine Declassified, which focuses its hatred on British Jews. Whilst Press TV may be banned from our airways, this foreign state hate operation is continuing online. Can we have a debate at some point on what more we can do to ensure that social media platforms tackle this outrageous content?
In the decade and a half since it was established, Press TV has found itself front and center of Western media attacks. But despite the pressure, the channel continues to advocate for the voiceless, chief amongst them, the Palestinians. The show at the heart of the latest onslaught is Palestine Declassified. Its host, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, gave his take on why the show was such a bone of contention for the pro-Israel lobby.
What we've seen here is a shameless attempt by the Israel lobby in the House of Parliament to whitewash Israel's criminality and lawlessness. And of course, they're very concerned about the fact that Palestine Declassified is shining a light into the murky corners of Israel's activities and indeed on the lobby that seeks to avoid any criticism of their suppression of the Palestinian people. It's Palestine Declassified is, you know, very effective. It scrupulously researches all of the content that we put out. And obviously, you know, they're embarrassed by the truth that we are bringing to a wider public. And of course, you know, the traction that Palestine Declassified is now picking up, it's been suggested, reaching well over 11 million people now. So they're doing their damnedest now, it seems to me, to try and close down our success.
Chris has written a stern letter rebuking some of the smears parroted by Andrew Percy.
There's no truth whatsoever to the allegations that you made. I mean, they suggested that, you know, we sort of are a vehicle for hatred towards British Jews. I mean, the programme is doesn't sort of promote hate in any respect, or suggested anyway, that he should consider apologising for maligning me and for impugning the reputation of Palestine Declassified and Press TV.
As Palestinians continue to live under an oppressive regime, Press TV's fight to advocate for justice will see it targeted as part of Israel's campaign to close down anyone who stands up for the Palestinian cause, a move branded media terrorism. Amina Taylor, London.
The members of the Pakistani parliament are insisting the coalition government to eliminate obstacles in starting the oil trade with neighboring Iran to overcome the country's energy deficiency. MPs' voices were heard during the recent meetings of the parliamentary committees, in which lawmakers stressed upon the government officials to robust diplomacy for aggressively pursuing options to secure waivers on the oil trade with Iran.
We get 1 million liters of diesel from Iran every day. It's called so-called smuggling. And it's, I think, 50 rupees per liter as compared to here. We should open this up. The region has to open up.
The lawmakers recommended that all-out efforts should be made to secure waivers from sanctions on oil trade with Iran.
I've been saying to the government also that we should open up these borders. Because, like, for the first time, Iran-Afghanistan trade is more than Pakistan-Afghanistan trade. And I think if they can have it, and it's benefiting both countries, so this trade would be very good for us also.
According to the data provided by Pakistan's Commerce Ministry to the Parliament, Pakistan's trade with Iran has crossed over $2 billion, covering food, medicines, cotton, and pharmaceutical products.
This is a huge project. We are engaged in talks with Pakistani authorities over this issue, and both countries will manage to come up with a positive solution very soon.
Like the rest of the world, Pakistan is no exception to the global energy crisis, which is worsening with each passing day. Experts say Islamabad plans.